A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You think these walls are ancient? They're not. The iconic limestone ramparts that define Jerusalem's skyline, the ones on every postcard and olive wood carving, were built between 1537 and 1541. That's less than 500 years ago. The Taj Mahal is older than parts of these walls. So here's what Daniel sent us. He's asking about the building of the old city walls, pointing out that the ancient city of Jerusalem actually began to the south of where the walls stand today. So what purpose did they actually serve? And how did Ottoman engineers get those massive blocks into place with 16th century technology? There's a lot to unpack here.
The timeline paradox is the thing that grabs you first. When Suleiman the Magnificent ordered these walls built, Jerusalem had already existed for something like 3,000 years. The city of David, the original Jebusite fortress that David conquered, sits on a narrow ridge south of the current Old City, just below the Temple Mount. That's where the archaeology points, Warren's Shaft, Hezekiah's Tunnel, the whole water system. By the 16th century, that area had been largely abandoned for centuries. The population had shifted north, clustering around the Haram al-Sharif and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So Suleiman wasn't walling in the ancient city. He was walling in a 16th century religious and administrative center that happened to sit on top of layers and layers of older stuff.
It's the architectural equivalent of building a fence around your neighbor's yard and calling it historic preservation.
That's actually not far off, and the walls look ancient because they were designed to. Ottoman builders deliberately reused Herodian and Roman stones. About 30% of the masonry is recycled from earlier structures. You can see it if you know what to look for. The lower courses at the western wall have those distinctive flat chisel marks from Herodian masons. Higher up, you see rougher point chisel work from the Ottoman crews. It's a visible timeline in the stone, like geological strata but made by human hands.
We've got three questions to work through. First, why build walls here if the ancient city was somewhere else entirely? Second, what purpose did they actually serve in the 16th century? And third, how did they move and place stones weighing up to 10 tons without anything resembling a modern crane?
Let's start with the man himself, Suleiman the Magnificent. Or Suleiman the Lawgiver, depending on which tradition you're drawing from, ruled the Ottoman Empire from 1520 to 1566. That's a 46-year reign at the absolute peak of Ottoman power. By the time he turned his attention to Jerusalem, he'd already conquered Belgrade, Rhodes, much of Hungary. He'd laid siege to Vienna. The man was building an empire, and he knew the power of monumental architecture to project legitimacy.
Jerusalem was not a strategically critical city for the Ottomans. It wasn't a major trade hub. It wasn't a military stronghold. It wasn't even a provincial capital. Damascus was the administrative center for the region. Jerusalem was a backwater. Religiously significant, sure, but economically and militarily negligible.
Which is exactly what makes the wall so interesting. Suleiman poured somewhere around 100,000 gold ducats into this project. In modern terms, adjusted for labor and materials, that's roughly $20 million. He deployed an estimated 10,000 workers over 4 years. For a city that wasn't generating revenue or defending a frontier, that's an enormous investment. So we have to ask, what was he buying?
He was buying a billboard.
The walls were a statement of Ottoman control over Islam's third holiest site. By the 1530s, the Safavid Empire was rising to the east, Shia Persians who challenged Ottoman Sunni legitimacy. The Portuguese were disrupting trade routes in the Indian Ocean. The Habsburgs were pressing from the west. Suleiman needed to assert that the Ottoman Sultan was the protector of the holy places, the defender of the faith. Rebuilding Jerusalem's walls was a way of saying, "We are the custodians of this city, and we're here to stay."
The walls were deliberately built to be more impressive than tactically optimal. This is the part that really gets me. Compare them to the Theodosian walls of Constantinople. Triple layers, a moat, staggered towers, kill zones between the inner and outer walls. Those were built for defense. Jerusalem's walls have no ditch, no outer wall, no bastions designed for enfilading fire. The gates are grand ceremonial entrances. Damascus Gate is basically a palace doorway with some crenellations on top.
Damascus Gate is the perfect example. It's the most elaborate of all the gates, a massive arched entrance with intricate stonework and a ceremonial plaza. It faces north, toward Damascus, which was the direction any serious military threat would come from. And yet it's designed for procession, not defense. There's no portcullis, no murder holes, no secondary gate to trap attackers in a killing box. Compare that to Jaffa Gate, which does have a right-angle turn, you enter, then immediately turn 90 degrees. That was a defensive feature, designed to slow a charging force and prevent them from building momentum. But even that is a half measure. A single gate with no portcullis is not stopping a determined army.
It's the architectural equivalent of putting a deadbolt on a glass door. It looks serious, but anyone who actually wants in is getting in.
Suleiman knew that. The walls were never intended to withstand a prolonged siege by a modern 16th century army with cannon. By the 1530s, artillery had already rendered tall stone walls largely obsolete. The real defenses of the Ottoman Empire were its field armies and its diplomatic corps. The walls were political theater, and they were very good theater.
The walls were a vanity project, but there's more to it than that. Let's talk about what they enclosed and what they deliberately excluded.
This is where the geography gets revealing. The walls follow the natural topography of the hills, the Western Hill, the Temple Mount, the Tyropoeian Valley. They enclose an area of about 0.9 square kilometers, roughly 4.5 kilometers in circumference. The average height is 12 meters, thickness about 2.5 meters. But the key thing is what's inside and what's outside. The walls enclose the Haram al-Sharif, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and the main market areas. They exclude the City of David to the south, Mount Zion in some sections, and the Siloam Pool.
That exclusion wasn't an accident. The City of David was where Jerusalem began, that narrow ridge between the Kidron and Tyropoeian valleys. By the 16th century, it was largely empty, partly because the water infrastructure had shifted. Hezekiah's tunnel still worked, but the population center had moved north, closer to the Temple Mount. The Siloam Pool was outside the new wall line, and without easy water access, nobody wanted to live down there. So when Suleiman's engineers drew the wall line, they looked at where people actually lived and worshipped, not where the ancient city had been.
There's a legend about this that I find fascinating. The story goes that Suleiman originally planned to include Mount Zion and the traditional tomb of David within the walls, but the two architects who drew up the plans somehow excluded it. Suleiman was so enraged that he had them executed. Their tombs are supposedly near Jaffa Gate. Is any of that true? The execution part is almost certainly not. Ottoman imperial architecture didn't work that way, and there's no contemporary record of it. But the story persists because it captures something real. The wall line was a set of deliberate choices, and those choices had consequences.
Including consequences that ripple into the present. The walls created the old city as a distinct entity. Before 1537, Jerusalem was a collection of neighborhoods and religious sites spread across the hills. After 1541, there was an inside and an outside. Everything within the walls became the old city. Dense, constrained, defined by its gates and its boundaries. Everything outside became the new city, which would eventually expand in the 19th and 20th centuries. The walls literally shaped the modern geography of Jerusalem, and, by extension, the contours of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict over the city's division.
They shaped how we think about the city's history. Tourists walk through the old city and assume they're walking through an ancient landscape. The street plan, the markets, the synagogues and churches, many of them are Ottoman or later. The Cardo, the Roman main street, is partially reconstructed. The Western Wall Plaza was expanded in the 1960s. The walls themselves, as we've established, are 16th century. But the perception of antiquity is so strong that it overrides the physical evidence.
The walls are basically a 16th century theme park of biblical history, and we've all been buying the theme.
Buying it enthusiastically. Which brings us to the engineering question. Because even if the walls were political theater, theater still requires stagecraft. How do you move a 10-ton block of limestone from a quarry 2 kilometers away, lift it 12 meters into the air, and set it precisely in place, all without engines, electricity, or modern steel?
This is where I get to watch you geek out over ancient construction techniques.
I am going to geek out. So let's start with the stone itself. The walls are built from limestone, specifically the same Melaki and Mizzi limestone formations that have been quarried in the Jerusalem hills for thousands of years. Meleke is the softer, whiter stone, easier to cut. Mizzi is harder, used for foundations and load-bearing courses. The quarries were within 2 kilometers of the construction site. Some of them are still visible today, like Zedekiah's cave near Damascus Gate. Short transport distances, which is the first thing any engineer would optimize.
2 kilometers doesn't sound far until you're dragging something that weighs as much as 2 elephants.
So the Ottoman engineers used a combination of techniques that had been refined over millennia. The primary method for moving large blocks was stone sledding. You'd cut the block at the quarry, dress it roughly, then lift it onto a wooden sledge. The ground would be wetted down to reduce friction. Wet limestone dust creates a surprisingly slick surface. Then teams of oxen would drag the sledge along a prepared track. We know from Ottoman records and from archaeological evidence at other contemporary construction sites that they used teams of anywhere from 20 to 40 oxen for the largest blocks.
That's a lot of oxen.
It's a lot of oxen. And coordinating them is a skill in itself. You need handlers who can get that many animals pulling in the same direction at the same time. The Ottoman Construction Corps had specialized teams for this. These weren't slaves, by the way, which is a common misconception. The workers were paid wages. We have payroll records from other Suleiman-era projects that show skilled masons earning significantly more than unskilled laborers.
The misconception that this was slave labor whipped into submission is wrong. These were professionals.
Professionals with guild structures and apprenticeship systems. The stonecutters, the masons, the mortar mixers, these were specialized trades, and the techniques they used were sophisticated. Once the blocks arrived at the construction site, the next challenge was lifting them into place. For the lower courses, they could use inclined planes, essentially building a dirt ramp and dragging the stones up. But for the upper courses, 12 meters up, you need something else. Cranes, but not the kind you're picturing. The Ottoman builders used a device called a shaduf. It's basically a lever system, like a seesaw with a bucket on one end and a counterweight on the other. For heavier loads, they combined this with a treadmill-powered winch. A large wooden wheel, maybe 4 or 5 meters in diameter, with men walking inside it to generate torque. The winch would lift the stone via a system of pulleys and ropes. It's slow, but it's incredibly precise. You can position a 10-ton block within a centimeter of where you want it.
A human-powered crane. How many men inside the wheel?
Typically 4 to 6, depending on the load. For the heaviest blocks, they might use multiple winches working in coordination. And here's the clever part. They built earthen ramps that were later removed. Archaeological excavations near Damascus Gate in 2024 and 2025 uncovered what appeared to be the foundations of these construction ramps. Compacted earth and rubble, deliberately laid down and then dismantled after the walls were complete. It's the construction equivalent of scaffolding, but for moving heavy things horizontally as well as vertically.
The ramp would go up to the level they were working on. They'd drag the stone up, set it in place, and then eventually remove the ramp entirely.
And that's why for centuries nobody could figure out how they did it. The evidence had been removed. It's only with modern archaeological techniques, particularly ground-penetrating radar and careful stratigraphic excavation, that we're starting to find the traces.
Let's talk about the mortar, because I know you've got something to say about the mortar.
I do have something to say about the mortar. The walls use a lime-based mortar mixed with crushed pottery, a Roman technique called coxiopesto. The crushed pottery, usually terracotta or brick dust, creates a pozzolanic reaction. It makes the mortar harden underwater and resist moisture penetration. This was critical for the foundation courses that sit in damp soil near the Gihon Spring and along the Kidron Valley. The Ottoman builders didn't invent this technique. They inherited it from Roman and Byzantine construction traditions that were still alive in the Eastern Mediterranean.
It's 16th century Ottoman engineering built on Roman material science, using recycled Herodian stones, on a wall line chosen for political rather than military reasons. This thing is a layer cake of historical recycling.
That's what makes it such a fascinating artifact. You can read the entire history of the region in the masonry. The Herodian stones at the base have those distinctive flat margins and smooth bosses. Herod's builders used a flat chisel that left a clean finish. The Ottoman stones above have rougher surfaces with point chisel marks. In some sections, you can see Roman-era stones that were reused by the Byzantines, then by the Umayyads, then by the Crusaders, and finally by the Ottomans. Each generation left its mark.
There's a specific example of this that I want to dig into. The largest stones in the wall, the ones that weigh close to 10 tons, where are they, and why are they there?
The largest blocks are in the lower courses, particularly along the southern and eastern sections of the wall. Many of them are recycled Herodian stones from the Second Temple period. The Ottoman builders didn't need to quarry new blocks of that size. They had a ready supply of massive, precisely cut stones from ruins that were literally lying around. The western wall's lower courses, the ones that are visible in the prayer plaza, are Herodian. But the Ottoman wall incorporated similar stones in sections that aren't as famous. You can tell the difference by the chisel marks and by the weathering patterns. Herodian stones have 2,000 years of patina, Ottoman stones only 500.
How do you get a 10-ton block to sit flush against its neighbor?
Patience and precision. The masons would dress the stones on the ground, rough cutting them at the quarry, then fine finishing them at the construction site. They'd use a technique called anathyrosis, where only the edges of the joining surfaces are smoothed, while the center is left slightly recessed. This creates a tight seal at the visible edges without requiring the entire surface to be perfectly flat. It's a time-saving technique that goes back to ancient Greece. Then they'd lower the block into place using the crane, check the fit, and if necessary, lift it back up and make adjustments. It's slow work, but with 10,000 workers in 4 years, you can get a lot done.
10,000 workers. That number keeps coming back to me. How do you feed and organize 10,000 people on a construction site in the 1530s?
Logistics were probably the hardest part of the entire project. The Ottoman administration had a sophisticated system for provisioning large-scale construction. They'd requisition supplies from surrounding districts, grain from the Jezreel Valley, timber from the forests of Lebanon, iron for tools from Anatolian foundries. The workers were organized into military-style units with clear chains of command. Each unit had its own cooks, its own quartermasters, its own medical support. It was essentially a small army, but one that built things instead of destroying them.
It was all done under the supervision of the chief imperial architect. Who was running this show?
The chief imperial architect at the time was likely Maimar Sinan, or at least someone from his office. Sinan was the greatest Ottoman architect. He designed the Süleymaniye Mosque in Istanbul, the Selimiye Mosque in Edirne, hundreds of other structures. He was active during exactly this period, and the Jerusalem walls bear some of the hallmarks of his approach: efficient use of recycled materials, careful attention to topography, and an emphasis on visual impact over pure defensive functionality. We don't have a signed blueprint saying Sinan designed the walls, but the circumstantial evidence is strong.
The Frank Gehry of the 16th century, basically.
More prolific than Gehry, but I take your point. Sinan designed something like 300 structures over his career. The man was a machine.
Let's pull back for a second and talk about what's not in the walls. The Golden Gate, on the eastern side, was sealed in 1541, supposedly by Suleiman himself. What's the story there?
The Golden Gate is the oldest of the gates, and it's the one that faces the Mount of Olives. In Jewish tradition, this is the gate through which the Messiah will enter Jerusalem. In Christian tradition, it's associated with Jesus' triumphal entry on Palm Sunday. The legend says that Suleiman heard a prophecy that a Jewish Messiah would enter through the Golden Gate and restore Jewish rule over the city. So he ordered it sealed with stone blocks to prevent the prophecy from being fulfilled. He also supposedly placed a Muslim cemetery in front of it because the Messiah, being a priest, couldn't walk through a graveyard without becoming ritually impure.
That's some high-level theological trolling.
It's either brilliant religious strategy or a complete myth. The historical evidence for the prophecy story is thin. More likely, the gate was sealed for practical defensive reasons. The eastern wall faces open terrain, and an unsealed gate there would be a vulnerability. The cemetery predates Suleiman by centuries. But the legend is revealing because it shows how the walls were understood, even in their own time, not just as physical barriers, but as instruments of religious and political control.
The walls as theological statement. Which brings us back to the core paradox. These walls were built to project Ottoman power, to protect a religious center, to make Suleiman look magnificent. They succeeded at all of that. But they also created a permanent division between inside and outside that shapes Jerusalem to this day. The walls turn the old city into a museum piece, a defined, contained preserve zone, while the real city grew up around it.
That's the knock-on effect that nobody planned for. Suleiman's walls created the old city as a concept. Before 1537, Jerusalem was just Jerusalem. Neighborhoods and holy sites spread across the hills. After 1541, there was a walled city and everything else. When Jewish neighborhoods like Mishkanat Sha'ananim were built outside the walls in the 1860s, they were seen as daring, even reckless. Living outside the walls meant exposure to bandits, to the elements, to the unknown. The walls had become the boundary of civilization itself.
Now, of course, the walls are a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and the old city is one of the most intensely contested pieces of real estate on Earth. Suleiman's vanity project became a geopolitical fault line.
Which is a pretty good argument for being careful about what you build. Monumental architecture has a way of outliving its original purpose and taking on meanings the builders never intended.
If someone's visiting Jerusalem, walking along the ramparts, what should they look for? Give me the field guide version.
First, look at the chisel marks. Herodian stones have flat, smooth margins. You can see them at the western wall's lower courses. Ottoman stones have rougher, point chisel surfaces. Once you start looking, you'll see the difference everywhere. Second, notice the gates. Damascus Gate is pure theater, a ceremonial entrance with no serious defensive features. Jaffa Gate has that right-angle turn, which is the closest thing to actual defensive design on the entire wall. Third, look at the wall line itself. From the Mount of Olives, you can see how the walls follow the topography, dipping into valleys and climbing ridges. They're shaped by the land, not by a geometric plan. And fourth, look at what's outside. The City of David is down there to the south, outside the walls. The ancient core of Jerusalem, the place where it all started, was deliberately excluded.
The walls are a 500-year-old argument about what Jerusalem is and who it belongs to, written in limestone.
The argument is still ongoing. That's what makes this more than just an engineering curiosity. Every stone in those walls carries political, religious, and historical weight. The Ottoman builders weren't just stacking rocks, they were making a claim.
Which raises a question that I think applies far beyond Jerusalem. What other ancient structures are actually much younger than we assume? How much of what we think of as timeless and eternal was actually built for reasons that were intensely political and very much of their moment?
The Great Wall of China, most of what tourists visit, is Ming Dynasty, not ancient. The Acropolis in Athens was a ruin that got reconstructed in the 19th century. Notre Dame, before the fire, was a 19th century restoration of a medieval original. We're surrounded by buildings that feel ancient but are actually reconstructions, restorations, or outright fabrications. Jerusalem's walls are just the most dramatic example.
The past is a construction project.
The construction never stops. Even now, in 2026, archaeologists are digging near Damascus Gate and finding traces of the Ottoman construction ramps. LIDAR surveys are mapping the wall's exact dimensions with millimeter precision. Ground-penetrating radar is revealing earlier foundations beneath the Ottoman stones. We're still learning how these walls were built, 5 centuries after the last stone was set in place.
Which means the walls aren't finished. They're still being built, not with stone, but with interpretation. Every generation adds its own layer of meaning.
That's the thing about monumental architecture. The builders think they're making a statement, but the statement keeps getting rewritten by everyone who comes after.
Here's what I keep coming back to. Suleiman spent 100,000 gold ducats and 4 years of labor to build a wall that was militarily obsolete before it was finished, that excluded the actual ancient city, and that was designed to look more impressive than it was functional. And 500 years later, that wall defines how the entire world sees Jerusalem. The vanity project worked.
It worked better than he could have imagined. Suleiman wanted to be remembered as the protector of the holy places, the great builder, the magnificent. And here we are, half a millennium later, still talking about his walls, still photographing them, still arguing about them. That's a pretty good return on investment.
The lesson being, if you want to shape how people think about a place for centuries, build something beautiful and let them project their own meanings onto it.
Build something that looks ancient even when it's new. Use old stones. Follow the old paths. Make it feel inevitable, like it was always there. The best monumental architecture doesn't announce itself as new. It whispers, "I have always been here, and I always will be."
Which is, of course, a lie. But it's a very effective lie.
The most effective kind. The kind that becomes true because enough people believe it.
The next time you're walking along the old city walls, running your hand over the limestone, remember, you're touching a 16th century Ottoman construction that's been mistaken for a 3,000-year-old one. You're touching recycled Herodian stones, Roman mortar technology, and a political statement that reshaped a city. And you're part of the story too, because every visitor who mistakes those walls for ancient is helping Suleiman's project succeed.
The walls are still doing their job. They're still making people believe.
Which leaves us with a final question. What else are we getting wrong about the past? What other walls, buildings, monuments are not what they seem? And how would we know?
We wouldn't, most of the time. Unless someone goes digging, literally and figuratively. Unless someone looks at the chisel marks and asks who made these and when and why. That's the historian's job, the archaeologist's job, and honestly, it's the job of anyone who wants to understand the world they're living in. Don't take the walls at face value.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, cartographers mapping the Outer Hebrides included a phantom island called St. Brendan's Isle on nautical charts, placing it roughly 120 leagues west of Barra. If you were sailing there based on those charts, you'd be traveling approximately 690 kilometers into the open Atlantic, which, for the record, is about the same distance as driving from London to the Scottish Highlands and back again, only to find absolutely nothing but water.
690 kilometers of ocean to find a cartographer's imagination.
That's a long way to sail for a ghost.
If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. It helps other curious minds find the show. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.